right, so we're moving on in polemical theology past the first third of that was setting the world to rights, as I call it. So we're showing how N.T. Wright in particular stands at the center of this emerging social, global gospel. And now we're moving on to the new pietism, which, by the way, is not going to be an utterly different group of thinkers. They're going to be in the same group for the most part. But just to do a little bit of review, we've already seen that the pietist tradition in Germany and the Puritan tradition in England attempted to revive the Reformation's life on very different intellectual foundations. For the Puritans, it was much more objective, and therefore I would say biblical, and therefore it was more holistic, which is another myth-buster for this group. But in America, the pietist mindset won out among the frontier, even though the Lutheran Church really didn't have a whole lot to do with it. Pietist thinking on the frontier dominated and created the American evangelical mindset. So to review, pietism is the reduction of the Christian faith to personal piety. Piety is just essentially it's a synonym for godliness. It's a good thing. So that's the first thing you need to know. We're not saying it's a bad thing. But anytime you take that suffix ism and put it on the end of a perfectly harmless and in many cases good word, you get this thing is the lens through which you see everything else. So, what is unbiblical is the reductionism. One's own piety becomes the epistemological lens. One's own personal spiritual feeling or one's own personal good works. So, this comes down to mean this as an epistemology, whether it's, you know, my own feeling or my own works. It's usually one of those two. It's religious experience, feeling, or good works. You'll notice the beginning of the 19th century liberalism with Schleiermacher emphasized feeling, and then eventually with the social gospel he emphasized works. But the difference between those things and then maybe the Puritan mindset, it was completely subjective. Everything is sort of reduced or sucked into that. The individual becomes the focus of the truth of things. So this, contrary to N.T. Wright's sophisticated yet misleading thesis, is the real secret to radical individualism in the modern church. It's pietism that created that. In the last 2 years of studying all this stuff, I've really, you know, gotten to see some of their concerns. Not only, you know, we're going to talk about presuppositionalists in a little bit, maybe not this session, but pietists, they have a lot of right concerns here and there. But wave after wave of anti-intellectual influences within the church have left us with a conceptual vocabulary where the body of their literature is being loaded into the emerging canons of an all-out frontal assault on classical Christianity. So the fault of this or that author might sometimes be that they don't really understand who they're speaking to. A lot of one of the main authors I'm going to criticize in this particular section is Michael Horton, in particular his book, The Christian Faith, for his pietism. Now, I think a lot of what he's saying, much like you can kind of do with Doug Wilson, you can smooth that out and you can pretty much say, okay, I know what he's saying. My criticism at this point, and I agree with what he's saying, my criticism at this point is, does this guy not understand the time and place in which we are living? People reading this, 80% of them, they're young, hip church planters, they're taking this in and filtering it through their relativistic grid. And so sometimes this is a matter of just knowing who our audience is. So these young church planters are salivating for any license to relativism that can justify their postmodern philosophy of ministry. There's another school I'm not going to talk about too much. I do write about them, but I'm not going to get into them too much here. If you ever see this school, the Radical Orthodox School, you really have to read completely irrelevant academic books to run into them. But there's definitely an affinity between Michael Horton and another guy that kind of gets into reform circles, James K.A. Smith, and this Radical Orthodoxy school. So they're going to be saying a lot of the same things. And the basic goal that they have is to expose the failure of modern secularism and to reassert a total Christian mind in both sacred and secular matters. And the idea that they have is that the sacred and the secular should not be different things altogether. So here you have history going this way. Let's just call that the secular. And the sacred, these two things should not be divorced. Well, they certainly shouldn't be divorced, but I think they would say that they shouldn't even be distinguished. And what the modern view has done is it's isolated the secular, and it started to define things in terms of this time and this place. And so their goal is pretty biblical when you first read it and run into it. But it doesn't see these spheres as distinct spheres at all. And one of the problems with not seeing them as distinct spheres is that if I just draw the same thing again and just change the terms around a little bit, if this is the old creation going this way, what we call the secular, if you don't make any distinction between the new creation and the old, you've got several problems. And then you can start to see where this view is going to have a lot in common with N.T. Wright and some of those guys. And so they start to challenge the notions that are shared by everybody in terms of modern theologians, from Abraham Kuyper to Carl F. H. Henry, with respect to changing culture. Because in their view, modern Christians have tried to change the culture only by accepting into our premises the lingo and the findings of secular social science. Just to give you one example of a small book that we've all read, I think, Bastiat's book, The Law. For Christians to use that kind of reference point or lingo, say, for example, as Thomas Jefferson, bad example because he's a deist, I understand that, but for us to be quoting even the Declaration of Independence as a truth of revelation and using words like self-evident, that is a secular starting point. Okay? So that's what these people are saying. Now, I think it's a worthy academic project to bring together the sacred and the secular in a way that Augustine did, and I think that's what they think they're doing. But they're doing it in a way that embraces wholeheartedly postmodernism. Back up a little bit faster. I'm trying to see what to fast forward through because some of it's really immaterial. Here's another irony to this whole thing. Postmodernism has made quite a stink about radical individualism, and they blame it on this or that element of the modern West. But as we've already seen, it's the postmodern denial of a common world that seals off the individual from community. If I can't talk about the same thing that you can talk about, then we've lost the only thing. If we lose communication, we lose community. That's why they come from the same word for that very reason. So whether the modern or the postmodern statisticians can pile up more pietists on one side or the other, what we need to see is that the postmodern philosophy absolutely demands pietism. Modernism might give you pietism, but postmodernism absolutely demands it. It seals off the individual from a common perspective. Because remember, there's no meta-narrative. There's no there's nothing transcendent that we all have to simply submit to. And so we all live in our own private worlds. So if you want radical individualism every time, start with postmodernism. That's one of the ironies of this whole thing. At any rate, there is a postmodern pietism, and that's really what we're going to talk about. So what we mean by this new pietism. The one, modern pietism, the old one, was a private reaction from within the modern framework. And in other words, it was just a bunch of disaffected types like Kierkegaard. You get a pietist as a reaction against the system. But within postmodernism, you have to be a pietist. It's an immediate consequence of the subjectivity of the postmodern framework. Now again, pietism is more generally understood to be the reduction of faith to personal piety and social action. So pietism becomes immediately incoherent, since if everything is reduced to the individual person, you're less likely to turn outward into a sphere of society. Hence, when pietism gets rolling, it usually only translates into good deeds, the ones that are in your own backyard, the ones that are in the mirror. In other words, ones that you don't have to intellectually justify, and things that you can't say to everybody else, here's what we all ought to be doing. Oh yeah, who says so? God's word over all of us, or some law or something like that, that's all out. On the other hand, the twin pillars of pietism can operate simultaneously if they're kept somewhat independent from each other. And that's what we see today. A postmodern pietism
that since it avoids systematic theology anyway, systematic thinking, it can exist as an inward turn against political science over here and as a communal reaction against effective apologetics over there. So you see how the two pillars of pietism, works and feeling, one is outward works, one is inward feeling. You say, how do these two things go together? And here's how they go together in pietism. You reject systematic thinking altogether. You have an inward turn against ethics out there. We all ought to be doing this. But you also have a communal reaction against apologetics. Don't judge that guy's grid. That's imperialism. So there's a common thread in these two strands of the new pietism. See, the old pietists couldn't get together. Good works, good feeling, don't really go together. One's outward, one's inward. But in postmodernism, you eliminate systematic theology. There's a common thread. There's a common enemy. So this is what glues the new pietism together. See, pietists really aren't going to make much of a dent in the world in the old way because they're inwardly driven. They're not going to make a dent. They have no argument. They have no basis to defend their view or to eradicate you. But the new pietism has a common enemy, and here it is. They use this word all the time. It's not a new word. Triumphalism. But it's been given a new coherent meta-narrative with no sense of irony. And that is us. We're triumphalists. What's a triumphalist? Well, in the new pietism, it's nothing but a code word for objective, sprinkled with a litany of bad apple examples of everyone who's ever acted arrogantly within these spheres. Anti-triumphalism, for all of its pseudo-biblical lingo, is a Marxist deconstructionist wedge that blames modernist objectivity. Remember, when they say modernist, they mean us. I know it's perverse. I know it's like, wait a minute, only a five-year-old would, but I don't understand. How are they equating modern with medieval? How are they equating objective truth with modernism? How are they equating systematic theology with the modern world? How does that work? How do people actually believe that? Surely this isn't in a lot of books. No, it's the main thesis today. Okay? When you see the word triumphalism, again, they're going to make that mean the ethical, the program of modernism, which is the same thing as classical. Wait a minute, I thought classical was pagan, Plato and Aristotle. Yeah, but it took a lot to bleed into the Christian synthesis. And the main culprits are the Reformed Scholastics and the Puritans. All right? So triumphalist, when you see that word, all it means is objectivity, objectivism, objective views of things, objects, pictures of the way the world is outside of us. The arrogance of anybody who has ever engaged in the task of apologetics or social action objectively. For instance, the evangelical response to secularization in the 20th century is often described in these books as, quote, the confused Constantinian project of the religious right. So start with that. What are you thinking? What are they thinking? The confused Constantinian project of the religious right, which has sought to colonize the public and political spheres by Christian morality, or the morality supposedly disclosed by, quote, natural law, end quote. There's a lot to chew on in a statement like that. One thing that never seems to occur to the critics of the, quote, right, which I teach our kids in our political science class, that's a myth, the whole left and right thing. It's a myth of the political spectrum meant to stop all thinking about invisible objects and just say, hey, if you're on that side, you're with the Hitler, you're scary. Okay, that's all that's meant to do. But it never occurs to critics of the right, as they call it, that there's a good case to be made that it was precisely in our ignorance of understanding natural law that typified the failure of the culture war. In other words, maybe the reason that Christians in the 20th century failed in the culture war is precisely because they didn't have a worldview. Another thing that the critics may be interested to know is that many adherents to natural law have been the biggest critics of political messianism, as it used to be called, in the 20th century, political idolatry. So we maintain that such a criticism does not need to see the metaphysical or political philosophy of the Western tradition as the cause of these mistakes in the same way as the radical orthodoxy school has. So here's the big idea in a picture. The criticism of the new pietism is that the objective worldview concept in general, so put it up here, objective worldview, and I'll put in parentheses apologetics. In other words, the imperialistic colonization of people's minds that treats our speech to them as objective. This is bigger than you, but really we're saying it's bigger than both of us. Both of us need to submit, but they're hearing it as bigger than you, better than you. Okay, so that conversation I had on Facebook with those guys would say, I'm the problem. Okay, that conversation is a problem. In this issue of homosexuality, we're imposing Christian morality on them by even saying that something is true over both of us. And so that's objective worldview in general, objective ethics in particular, and I'll put in parentheses here, political science, saying things like natural law dictates certain unalienable rights, things like that, is the ethical wing of this imperial colonial abuse. Okay, so translation even further. Everything you ever thought was good is actually evil. I'm not kidding. Yeah. I know, if you say it like this, no way. No, that can't be the case. Okay, well, we're human beings and we have basic human needs, so in one sense you're right. They can't really live by this worldview, just like postmodernists can't. Relativists can't really, really get on in life believing that. But do their books say this with a straight face, consistently cover to cover? Absolutely. They've invested their whole lives to undo what Christians have been doing for 20 centuries. Now, they'll fool themselves into thinking that it's been mostly in the modern world, and we have to get back to a pre-modern view. Let's unpack this a little bit. The more general case against this triumphalism has become a shallow sloganeering campaign that, for all its drivel, is effective and leaves opposing viewpoints without a voice. Notice it's becoming more and more difficult to argue for these things in the church today, unless you plant your own church and do it. I was reminded of the interview. You ought to watch it one time. Go on YouTube and find it. I'm not trying to pick on people, but I think it's very telling. I feel bad doing it, but whatever. The interview that Wayne Grudem was given an interview by, what's that guy? The guy in Britain. He's kind of a charismatic Calvinist. I don't remember his name.
Charlie's?
No, it's a Charlie's type guy. I just can't remember the guy's name. Just slipped right out of my mind. Andrew something, rather. Doesn't matter. So, British guy in general. And of course, they're not as far to the right anymore as we Americans are. So, you know, take that in context. And he's interviewing Grudem right after Grudem had written his book, Politics, which I think is a breath of fresh air, much like the Truth Project, given where the church has gone in a quick 10 years, where all this stuff is an embarrassment now. This guy, I'm telling you, and he's given Piper interviews before and things like that, good guy, as far as I could tell, good theology. He was physically shaking as Grudem was talking to him. I'm not kidding. Watch the interview. He was physically uncomfortable. He looked like he was ill, and he may have been, okay? I'll cut him some slack there. I don't know. But he was physically shaking. As if he was interviewing, I don't know, O.J. Simpson after the interview, or after the murder or something, and or Hitler, he's just like, he's shaking because of what Grudem's saying, and which was basic 101 stuff. He wasn't really getting deep or anything yet. This is where we're at, people. This is where we're at. Things have changed in the past 15 years very, very quickly. At a rate that would have made Orwell not believe it in his fiction, in terms of the meaning of words and stuff like that. Just like any other effectively dangerous idea, such anti-triumphalism, and again I'm putting that in quotes, is going to say a lot of things that the Bible really does say, and condemn a lot of things that really did happen. So we're going to have to do some critical thinking. The questions we'll have to ask will be similar to those five objections against doctrine that we looked at the very beginning of the Doctrine and Division study. Objective worldview talk in general and objective political science in particular is all now made equal to the triumphalist error. Our church is a triumphalist heresy. Our church is a horrid exercise in triumphalism, just so you know that. Okay? If we could boil the problem in these thinkers down to a sentence, perhaps we could summarize it like this. Maybe a verbal way to say that big idea. The objectivity of objects. I'm going to parenthesize this in a second, unpack these. The objectivity of objects has been utterly confused with the hyper-objectification of the subject. Hyper-objectification used to mean, among philosophers, that the person is kind of treating their mind like a Polaroid camera. Like they have the ability to lift themselves above the fray and take a picture of the world, and there it is in all its glory. I have that ability. So it's something, it's an action of the individual standing from an objective perspective. It's hyper-objectification. Perfectly legitimate description of something. But that's now the only thing you mean by the word objectivity. So the objectivity of objects now means the hyper-objectification of the subject. Explain that one other way. The objectivity of objects, in other words, real states of affairs as they are. So 2 + 2 = 4 in every possible world. That's an object of the mind. That's the primary meaning of object and objective throughout 2,500 years of people building up civilization against pagan and non-pagan barbarism. Civilization, a good thing so that we don't kill each other, which we surely would and still are in just a more sophisticated way, and that probably plays a trick on people too. Civilization, good, because raping, pillaging, murdering, dismembering, burning, just for kicks, bad. Right? Can we agree? I'm just aiming low at this point. Okay? Can we agree that's bad? Because we can't, apparently. Because I'm telling you right now, that statement is a triumphalistic statement. Huh? Object in that world used to mean this is a piece of chalk. Both the piece of chalk on the phenomenological level that changes and the real state of affairs, as Aristotle would have meant the form of it, is an object, and I'm speaking objectively when I say that. Now, the word object and objective means the subjective. I'm being the polar right now. I'm putting myself in a privileged position. I can see the whole better than you can, which is why I'm going to burn you. Okay? That's the idea today. Any attempt to discern the object and persuade others. So let me repeat that. Any attempt to discern the object and then persuade others by virtue of its objectivity. In other words, look at that thing, it's important. Whether in apologetics, doctrine, or ethics, is now broadly called triumphalist, modernist, secular. Anything that ends in a period and doesn't lisp is now called triumphalist. Even Orwell wouldn't impress at the speed that this post-evangelical newspeak has caught on. It really only took a single decade, from 2000 to 2010. In this bizarro world, the word objective now means its opposite, a subjective disposition of moral neutrality or privileged position of the observer. So you see that chart over there that we're teaching our kids? Because our kids will not be impressed by this in a few years. Okay? The subject is the knower. The object is the thing known. Tree, object, me looking at the tree, however I perform at looking at it, that's the subject. Now, guess what object means? The opposite. The subject. This is not good. This is a shift to an Eastern worldview, where thou art that. That's the Eastern maxim. So now, the word objective, the concept of objective, is now a subjective disposition of either moral neutrality, I'm being objective,
morally neutral toward these objects. We talk like that all the time. Nothing wrong with using that in a secondary sense, but if that's the only thing you mean by it, you now mean the opposite. You are now ripe to be silly putty for the devil. Or it means a privileged position of the observer. I can see what you can't. I can see such that nothing in me is going to inhibit me from seeing, like sin, for example, or bias. So even very helpful books among evangelical authors that we like bear this presuppositional stamp. Andreas Kostenberger, in his excellent book called Excellence, very good book, nevertheless, floats into this language. On page 79, he says, and he's talking about the modern view, and he says this, and I agree with what he says here, but listen to the, see if you catch it. By and large, the spirit of the Enlightenment fostered confidence in the scholar's intellectual skills and in objective neutral analysis, while the scriptures encourage prayerful dependence on the guidance and power of the indwelling spirit to lead us into truth. And then he cites the verses. Amen to that contrast. That's exactly right. But what has become of the primary meaning of the word object as a noun? That we should be unaware of how its contrary has become a first-order epistemology. Objective is now only ever allowed to mean a subjective position or a disposition of neutrality. Hopefully you can see how this is important as a foundation, as a card trick that happens at the foundation to the criticism. The criticism will now flow easy. The traffic of the criticism now has no cop or border patrol called logic to stop him and say, wait a minute, whoa, what are you saying there? He's done his work. Objective now only means privileged, naive, neutral perspective of the subject. And from that position I can begin to abuse. Postmodern pietism stands against the worldview concept in general. As we've said before, a great many conservative evangelical scholars are seeking to transcend modernity only by accepting some of postmodernism's basic tenets, even while they are consciously critical of other elements of it. Others will go as far as to join the emergent church in their attempt to get behind the rationalist superstructure of the West to either the pre-modern mindset or even that retained by the Eastern church. A generation earlier, just to show you that this didn't pop out of nowhere in the year 2000, a generation earlier in 1983, Herbert Schlossberg's Idols for Destruction was much more at home in the ascending cultural evangelicalism that relished the worldview concept. It's a lesser known book, but pretty much in the same vein as, like, I don't know, a little bit of Francis Schaeffer and a little bit of David Wells mixed together. Decent book, good book for looking at worldviews and assessing worldviews from a biblical perspective. Yet even he saw the biblical narrative, its objects and their meaning, as a description of what he called concrete particulars within history, and insisted that Platonism, by which he meant any search for truth in grand generalizations and vast intellectual constructs, has, quote, always had a harmful influence on Christianity. So here's a book that's basically good, using these words, Platonism. So he's not attacking the word objective or object yet, so there's a slow evolution going on, you can tell. In the heyday of evangelical cultural engagement and apologetics, here's a good author, arguing in the same vein as Schaeffer in a lot of ways, confusing grand generalizations and vast intellectual constructs with Platonism. This misreading of the Christian insight into the essence of things did not pop out of midair at the turn of the millennium, in other words. And now I'm going to talk about Horton a lot, because you're going to see in Michael Horton's book, The Christian Faith, a huge going to work on this idea. Horton, first of all, distinguishes between a meta-narrative, say scientism, the belief that science is the not only the final court of appeals, but really the only great intellectual objective study, the meta-narrative versus a what he called a mega-narrative. So Christianity is not just another meta-narrative. Well, if you say it like that, I agree with that. So you have to come up with another word for it. Meta-narratives. Let's give the postmoderns one thing. This 19th century idea of meta-narratives from the German perspective are naive and abusive and so on. So here's all your meta-narrative right here. Get the idea.
Horton distinguishes between those that are attempting to be a lens through which you see everything versus the real thing. But rather than call this the real thing, he just comes up with a different word for it, mega-narrative. It's the big story. It's the real story. Okay, I can go with that. I agree with that. Might not have said it like that, but sure. But what he does in doing so is he joins in with all those who treat the old idea of truth justification as an attempt to ground or translate, those were his words, to ground or translate the real story in terms of the meta-narrative. So, truth justification.
In other words, here's my foundation. I'm talking to an unbeliever, talking to somebody who thinks they exist outside of this story. And I say something like, well,
if any of us are right about what's right here, there has to be such a thing as right. Right? So like my conversation on Facebook with the guy who is defending homosexuality and attacking the idea of a Christian foundation for that idea of truth justification.
Now, it did have that word. Truth justification. So in other words, epistemology, another word that will be used is criteria. So a criteria for truth or a truth justification.
A first principle of deduction. An axiom. A presupposition. But it's one that you argue to. You justify it. You ground your system in some first thing that you can both agree upon. That idea, grounding or translating, that first of all, you see the equivocation. You're not, I'll go with the word ground. You're giving a ground to it, a first principle. But translating the whole story into that common idea that he has with me? Is that what you're saying? And you can see that Horton really has a sympathy and maybe is a presuppositionalist completely. He's reformed. Law of averages, he probably is a presuppositionalist. But he says, quote, the biblical faith claims that its story is the one that God is telling. Alright, good. Which relativizes and judges the other stories about God, us, and the world. Okay, every other one is relative and judged by the biblical story. Okay, gotcha. Meta-narratives attempt to justify us and judge the rest of the world. When in the biblical faith, God judges us as well as justifies the ungodly. End quote. Wait a minute. What just happened? Did you just midway start using the word justify to mean something soteriological and no longer epistemological? Did you catch it? Meta-narratives attempt to justify us and judge the rest of the world, when in biblical faith, God judges us as well as justifies the ungodly. So the meaning that we pour into the words relative, judge, and justify are crucial here. It seems that Horton is equating the epistemological sort of justification, in other words, rational grounds for knowledge, with the soteriological kind of justification, in other words, right standing before God. Now, you can do that if that's what your claim is, if you're saying that psychologically, epistemological justification always goes hand in hand with soteriological justification. If you want to propose a psychological theory that says that, I'm okay with that. We can analyze that. But he never admits that's what he's doing. He just sort of, what I would say about the fallacy of equivocation, a little card trick's going on here, where he's just assuming and asking us to go along with this synonym, with this synonymous treatment of an epistemological justification, rational grounds for knowledge, with a soteriological kind. In other words, if I try to convince you of the Christian faith, I'm justifying myself before God and judging you. And likewise, the philosophical judgment of propositions and actions is blended with the judicial judgment of people's souls and worth. Think of the conversation Doug Wilson's right now having with Thabiti, Adam Wheely, and the other guy. Lurtz on the Gospel Coalition thing about the racism and his book Black and Tan, Brown and Tan. What? Yeah, so he's having that whole discussion, and at the end of the day, the criteria, of course this isn't a criteria, and only we have criteria, but the criteria, when you empty out criteria,
is whether or not you've offended me, whether or not you've made me feel bad. If I feel bad, then you have a moral obligation to either no longer believe what you do that's making me feel bad, or at least keep it to yourself. This is the problem. You can't uphold civilization if we're that afraid of our own shadow. Behind this blending of terms is the sense in which the terms within meta-narratives are relative to biblical truths. So remember, one of the things Horton said was, in the biblical view, all other views are relative, to the degree that they're true, are relative to what God says in His story. Well, amen to that. What is he going to mean now by an idea being within another meta-narrative? The traditional evangelical view of Scripture would agree with the statement that the truth of any extra-biblical statement is relative to the truth of the statements in Scripture. But isn't that just another way of saying that the two, the Bible and Aristotle, for example, are talking about the same objects at various points, even if with vastly different degrees of accuracy? So that the Bible gets to correct Aristotle at every point, but it's a point that he gets that the Bible corrects it at. Not 2 points. Not a non-point. So isn't this another way of saying that this is the same object talked about by two levels of revelation, even if with vastly different degrees of accuracy? Somebody would say, no. The two are competing authorities on the question of the object. But again, which object? One or two? A or non-A? So, for example, when Plato pictures the soul to be invisible and immortal, should we expect the Bible to mean something fundamentally different by those words? When Aristotle speaks of quantity and quality, should we assume that the threeness of the water cycle is something fundamentally different as a number than the threeness of the Trinity, just to be disagreeable to the pagan? And if we say that the threeness of the Trinity is much more essential than the threeness of the water cycle, do we mean the same thing by it? Hopefully you can get a sense of the problem. In other words, how relative are we talking about here? Is the extra-biblical connotation relative to the specific biblical designation, which would be true, or is it relative per se, given Scripture's mega, not meta, narrative status? Here's the other thing that Horton winds up objecting to. Plato's basic framework for truth as intellectual seeing, I don't even like calling it Plato's, the classical and then therefore the classical Christian and the medieval and Puritan and everybody down to the present day who's Reformed, the framework for truth as intellectual seeing is reduced in the emerging thesis to Plato's particular views on the soul and recollection. So if you believe in intellectual seeing, the soul is recollecting something that it has on its own already. And learning new things is pit against remembering the eternal truth. So for Plato, you could know things as opposed to just opinion because you had access to it, and the job of the teacher in Socrates was kind of like an intellectual midwife. You'd birth out, you'd lead out this stuff that's already inherently there, and in Plato's idea, because of past lives. So all that baggage comes with the idea of intellectual seeing. Now this is where the rubber meets the road in Horton's thought, and where his language is most likely to go astray. In examining the character of theology, he asks a very standard question that always comes at the beginning of a theological or systematic theology textbook. Is theology theoretical or a practical science? And in this context, seeing is compared to hearing in that contemplation. So contemplation, theoria, is the word that we get the word theoretical from. In this idea, seeing, theory, is active or grasping, while listening or hearing is passive and receiving. So Horton does something very well in all of his other books in criticism of the modern seeker church, these work projects that everybody's doing against the gospel. That's where Horton's at his best. But watch what he's going to do in this question. The idea is that thinking, theory, seeing, insight
is the soul grasping something on its own, while listening is passive and receiving. So, the former theory, seeing, contemplation, reflection in here, seeing, grasping, insight, is going to be more consistent with works righteousness. And the latter, hearing, is going to be more consistent with resting and receiving the grace of God. As the argument goes, the trouble has come when in the course of the West, seeing and light metaphors became the master metaphor for knowledge and experience, so that it becomes the private property of either the mystic or the rationalist. All outer reality is rejected and we are left with a new Gnosticism. So on this point, Horton is going to be in complete agreement with N.T. Wright. Insight theory, individual soul of individual objects, Gnostic. Horton's going to add to that and say, and leads to works righteousness. Behind this is a dualistic assumption to begin with, says Horton, a kind of metaphysical division of realities inherent to the pagan starting points to philosophy. And certainly that has been there. We've chronicled that in the early part of church history. But wasn't it the very genius of Augustine and Thomas Aquinas to unify reality where Plato and Aristotle could not, to correct them, to give a theological explanation for what they were looking at? And when Christian theology took over for pagan philosophy, it was not a movement from seeing to hearing, much less theory to practice. The truth is that the Bible uses all of these metaphors freely to describe how our souls encounter the truth of God. Yet Horton suggests that the light metaphors in Scripture are strictly, quote, ethical, eschatological, covenantal, and historical transition from sin to redemption, end quote. Not primarily intellectual. To eliminate discovery of truth via the intellect from this list is an arbitrary exclusion, to say the least. So Horton uses quite a bit of ink, giving us a great deal of insight about just how much insight should be marginalized. Again, you always have to cut the branch you're sitting on when you want to take an irrational worldview. He's giving us a lot of insight about how much insight should be marginalized. At the end of the day, the operations of the mind in the light metaphor are said to have the effect of turning us inward. You hear the emergent church saying that? Reformed young church planters expecting reformed mentors in church planting will now be reading this in Horton and reformed authors. At the end of the day, the operations of the mind in the light metaphor are said to have an effect of turning us inward, where our solitude is meant to purify us from the shadows of time and space and, yes, even community. In fact, he suggests it is the primacy of ideas model in the West that lends itself toward trusting in images against words. One supposes that it is nothing but an asymmetrical coincidence that the primacy of hearing may lend itself toward trusting in sound bites and slogans over words. So the fact is that both the audio and the visual can be manipulated. Remember, the first lie in the history of the world was the twisting of spoken, audible words. Yet Horton is persistent in his thesis, quote, seeing is not believing, it is possessing. Seeing is not believing, it is possessing. And here, remember, seeing with the mind. Now, all of this may sound impressive at first glance, and it might even seek to borrow from the early structuralism where the spoken word preceded the written, but it seems to ignore the analogical aspect of that very metaphor when it's drawn out in Scripture. Not by philosophers, but by Jesus himself. In Matthew 6, 22, 23, he says, "The eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness?" Now, is he talking about a physical eye there? If you have good eyes, but you're in a wheelchair, so long as you can see, your legs will get better? Is that what he's talking about? Of course not. He's talking about the eye of the mind, the soul, the invisible seeing. So the light in you is clearly revealed by God himself. And yet our eyes that Jesus appraises here are our eyes and not part of the Word. So both light waves and sound waves come from outside of us. The information that these phenomena stimulate in our sensory receptors form a synthesis inside of us.
So to pit one against the other, as if they represent revelation and reason respectively, simply barking up the wrong tree. First of all, Horton's acting as if he's forgetting that the whole thing's a metaphor to begin with. There are things from outside of us informing us in terms of sensory stimuli, but that's the earthly thing. That's a metaphor. It's a picture. In our souls, both hearing and seeing take on a completely different dimension. At any rate, Horton contrasts theology as light to theology as sound, in calling the latter covenantal speech. So theology as sound, hearing is receiving, it's more grace and communal. We exist in the community first. We are not autonomous selves carving out worlds with our propositions. When we use propositions in this classroom, we're carving out worlds, burning down rainforests, killing the baby seal, you know, all that good stuff. Now mark this, in these thinkers, grasping at insight always equals autonomy. Grasping at insight into the way the world is always equals autonomy, anti-communal, inwardly driven. It's not clear how they obey the words of Solomon in Proverbs 4:7, get wisdom, and whatever you get insight. Get, act of your will, insight. Now, what distinguishes Horton from emergent types who would say the same thing is that here's where Horton's better. Horton specifies this community as the people of God, whereas the emergents would draw no such boundary. For them, the community is everyone. But here's what they have in common. Sight is possessive. It's imperialistic, but at first it's an act of your will, that kind of justification. Hearing and presenting yourself within the community is submissive. Now, why we cannot be struck blind and presented in submission by light is never really explained. It seemed to get Moses, Isaiah, and Paul's attention. And he is quite right that in the biblical worldview, audio communication precedes visual communication, because by his word, God created everything that is. But lest we forget, the analogy of light and sight is in contrast to the analogy of hearing and sound. Both are analogies to the invisible realm of which our intellects, not our sense organs, perceive. And we should point out that it was God's speech that created and therefore preceded light, not our hearing of that speech that preceded light. Horton blurs the boundaries between the senses in which these are analogies and the senses in which they are not. I'll come back to this, how this moves from the general thesis, objective worldview, evil, imperialistic, everything bad, to objective ethics. We'll come back to that. Well, it'll be Sunday where we talk about objective ethics and political science. So, questions?
Matt, the word triumphalism, where does that come from? What's the triumph?
Oh, the church triumphant versus... So, sometimes we'll talk about the church militant, the church triumphant, the church in suffering. So they're different in theology. They're actual words that have been used by systematic theologians to describe different states of the church. Hopefully, in their theology, mirroring the doctrine of Christ. So the doctrine of Christ, his humiliation and exaltation, ought to inform our doctrine of the kingdom, its inauguration versus its consummation. And so, in Augustine's view, the biblical view, the triumph of the church has two aspects, or the exaltation. Namely, the city of God now already exists and informs this world, but it's not consummated until the second coming of Christ. So, different extremes of eschatology. Again, secondary issue that bleeds into the essentials and makes us totally different kinds of Christians, totally different kinds of people, depending on how we fall out on it.
Is the word... something that we came up with, or is this a name?
Theologians, basically, to say that the kingdom's already arrived. We're better than you. The only task left is to send you to hell with our tanks.
Okay. Imperialism.
Yeah. It's the Marxists very quickly jumped on that theological concept. Yeah. And so now it's only used by theologians who are essentially Marxists. They don't know it. They don't know this is where they're getting this. But...
So it's a term of derision to them.
Yeah.
From their point of view.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it is a bad thing if you are really guilty of it. If you are really guilty of believing the kingdom is consummated now through my dominance of you, either intellectually or politically, then if I'm really guilty of that, then that is a bad thing. So that's the battle. What does that look like? Who's guilty of it and why? Why would somebody be guilty of that? That's the there's an ad hominem attack, you know, with straw men loaded on that, you know, and it's being shoved into our walls like a Trojan horse. And we're supposed to just accept these definitions. But we got to push that horse out of the wall quick and say, no, that's you're getting that from a Marxist worldview. This is meant to detonate the whole idea of the Christian worldview and the gospel. And it's being handled by people that are, in my opinion, naive. Others that they're all for that. They really are consistent Marxists and want to, you know, deconstruct the West and so as to destroy the West. Others, like Horton, or a lot of the people that, most of the people that young, the new Cals are reading are just, Lenin had a phrase for it that I won't repeat here because I'm still recording and I want to be nice. But anybody who knows what I'm talking about, too late. Yeah, there's the one. You know, I have to be nice because I'm pastor, but the reality is that's the reality.